The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. A sunny Thursday, late morning in Southern California. An epic NBA game tonight. Game 7 of the 2010 Finals. In my opinion, the biggest game in 22 years for the National Basketball Association. And we have... in a situation like this, you got to get a big guest. So we had to go to Mount Rushmore of the BS Report. We had to go get Chris Connolly. He's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now. What's happening?
I'm doing all right. How much is your behavior at this hour equivalent to the behavior of, say, Angelina Jolie when she was in high school? Given what you're going through as you look forward to Game 7 tonight.
It's so weird you say that because I'm wearing goth makeup and I just got 3 tattoos. So I would say very similar.
So long as the cutting hasn't started yet,
no,
I think we're all right.
No cutting. We have a wrinkle. He's not going to contribute, but he has headphones on and he's listening. My dad is sitting here staring at me right now, listening.
Is that right? Wow.
He's going to be one of those co-hosts. He's like Norm's wife in Cheers.
And like the Heisenberg principle, you know, or something. We'll see if being observed changes the way we behave.
Dad, say hi so they know I'm not kidding.
Hello.
How are you?
See?
Hey, I
turned his mic off. Hold on.
I'm very, very nervous. I thought you weren't going to say anything.
I can totally understand and appreciate that.
I mean, Jacqueline, are you there?
I'm here.
This is BS Report history right now. My dad is a co-host.
It's amazing. I was here when your wife was on the podcast. I'm here when your dad's on the podcast.
It's unbelievable. Well, he's just going to sit here.
I just turned into Artie Lang, by the way.
He's just going to sit here and not say anything. Dad, I'm turning your mic off. If you have anything to contribute, signal me. He's an emotional wreck. In fact, I haven't seen him this nervous since I was used this example, but it's worth mentioning that 2-5 I had in college when he looked physically ill, that he had just paid $20,000 a year for my college education, and I came up with a 2-5. Chris Connolly. Before we get into Celtics-Lakers,
sure.
Let's talk about that 30 for 30 last night with the OJ's car chase. I was hoping it was going to be a big hit, and it was one that I had a personal attachment to because we kind of developed that one internally, and we were hoping we'd find a director. I wasn't prepared for the feedback that it got. I would say that of all the feedback we've gotten after 30 for 30, that might have been the most passionate that I've gotten from friends, people on Twitter, stuff like that. Did you watch it last night? Or did you see it?
I didn't watch it last night, but I've seen the film and definitely enjoyed it. So I'm keen to know what kind of response you did get.
Well, I think the interesting thing to me, and I felt the same way as I watched it, was that you kind of just forget the actual car chase and that whole day and what a seminal moment that was in American history and what a TV night that was and how that really, you know, as I've mentioned on the podcast, doesn't have the same gravity of 9/11, but... it has the same, I remember exactly what I was doing, where I was, and what happened that whole night when it happened. And I think that, you know, as the years pass and the trial kind of took over and how polarizing it was racially and all that stuff, I think people have kind of forgotten a little bit just what an insane night that was. Now, you were in Los Angeles when that happened. Walk us through your night that night.
I was at the offices of Premiere Magazine, the late lamented movie magazine, and perhaps fittingly, I was preparing to go to Paramount on the other side of town to watch this new movie that there was a lot of buzz about called Forrest Gump.
Wow.
And so I was all set to go, and, you know, we'd heard good things. It was Tom Hanks and Robert Zemeckis, and wasn't really sure what it was about, but there was good buzz on it, and then this thing started to evolve. Now, our offices were on Bundy. They were on Bundy and Olympic. So
isn't that
my
right?
Route home, you know, went past the murder site.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's like right, within a couple blocks, right?
Yeah, yeah. But one of the great things about the movie is that you hear in the voices of the people who have known O.J. Simpson in the media, or at least who have worked with him, trying to wrap their minds around the two images that are coming forward at that particular moment. The OJ that they know and have worked with and enjoy, and the OJ that they increasingly are coming to understand may have been involved in these horrific murders.
Right.
And I'll admit being just like them, with the exception of never having worked or known O.J. Simpson, because I can remember seeing the coverage of him being handcuffed for the first time and thinking, well, that's just outrageous, as if he's not mourning enough that they're doing this to him. That just seems, you know, beyond the pale. That's how naive I was at that stage. So instead of going to Forrest Gump, just sort of sat and watched it transfixed on TV, wound up going home. We live over in a very different area of Brentwood called Brentwood Glen. And I could actually stand on my front yard and see the Bronco coming up the 405 freeway on its way to OJ's house.
Wow.
So
that was pretty cool.
It was just as crazy as the movie indicates.
Yeah.
At the time, as we both would agree.
And yeah, as you pointed out, I think people, it was just so incredible that he would have actually done this, that it did seem like there was a sense of he's innocent or you know, it's like the way LA rallied around him and people pulling over the highways and signs supporting him and all that. It seemed like not only did people not want to believe that he did it, but people had talked themselves into him not doing it.
Well, I think by then, and you can hear it in the words, you know, and the movie does a great job of sort of having, you know, Tom Brokaw referring to it as a Shakespearean tragedy, and Al Michael, you know, talking about it. You can hear people in the process of wrapping their minds around something, and that's something, that's a really rare thing to hear in live television, I think. And that's one of the things that makes, as you say, the movie so striking, is that they are literally, these figures who are so articulate under these circumstances are literally in the process of wrapping their minds around what's going on at that moment. Because really, I think at that moment is the moment when you realize, wow, maybe he was involved in this kind of thing.
Well, I remember
we really have to get our minds around that now.
I remember I was at a wedding the weekend before in Pittsburgh, and I think she died on a Saturday night or a Sunday night or something. But I was with at least one of my friends, and we heard the news, and you know, I was like, wow. But then I had remembered, because, you know, being a huge sports fan, I had remembered the domestic violence thing, and I remember thinking, he couldn't have done it, right? And we had that whole conversation. We both agreed, yeah, no way this guy did it. And then over the course of that 5 days, as it, you know, police wanted to talk to him, and, you know, I think all of us were like, wow, he's a suspect? You know, yeah. But not assuming he actually may have done it. And then, as you said, the car chase was, and still we needed 8 hours, and even then we couldn't really wrap our heads around it. And, you know, Brett Morgan said in the doc yesterday, in one of his little interviews, he was saying that he felt like that's when the reality TV craze took off. Now, I would actually disagree with that, because I think the real world started the reality TV craze in 92. I think that what changed that day, and then what happened with the internet starting really a year or two later, was people being able to instantly process a developing news story through television, and then being able to talk with each other through cell phones, through whatever. And it seemed that to me was the last pre-internet giant story where all the seeds were planted, but it hadn't come together yet. And
I think you're right about that. I mean, I think that was a smart insight that yeah, it was the first one that you didn't follow on the internet, the first one you didn't share thoughts about on the internet. You wonder now if, yeah, I guess it was just such a dramatic moment that you still would follow it on television. You think now when you follow a live event, you're not always watching TV. If you really want to know every little beat, you kind of have both screens going. But in terms of being able to share what you thought was happening or concoct theories about what was going on, or the internet obviously didn't exist to that degree at that moment. So we were literally all in front of our TVs with our jaws down. And fittingly enough, as is captured in the movie, it is a Kardashian that brings us into the new age.
It was. It's an amazing, amazing coincidence.
They are the Kevin Bacon of celebrity scandal. You can get to the Teapot Dome scandal. You can go to the XYZ affair from early American history in six moves from the Kardashians. It's amazing that way.
I actually think the OJ trial verdict was the last mammoth pre-internet moment, because now you look at the internet culture we have now, especially in 2010 with Twitter. Oh, my dog is even fired up. You just heard him bark.
Maybe he's playing Artie Lang.
So if that happens in 2010, first of all, the day after the murders, there's internet conspiracies, I think. And
yes, there are, yes.
And
we
are...
We phrase Colombian necklace a lot faster, don't we?
Yeah, and I think maybe a picture surfaces. There's a lot of different grisly ways that could have gone those first 2 days. And I think within 48 hours, people, you know, the OJ, people are saying he did it, basically, on the internet. That would have been, and there's websites popping up, all that stuff. And then the other thing I think that would have been so different, imagine Twitter during the car chase. That would have been the all-time trending topic ever.
Well, Twitter shut down on Monday, right? And I was convinced that was because it was the day everyone from Twilight was doing prep.
You mean it got overloaded or something?
I mean, we interviewed Robert Pattinson for Nightline, but I know he was doing other interviews, and he was on Kimmel, I think. I just think that Twilight shut down Twitter for about an hour just because people love to talk about it. You're absolutely right. The car chase would have melted the servers on Twitter and all those sort of sites in the pure bouncing back and forth. Although really all you could just keep saying was, wow.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly captured in the documentary. Even though you know how it all plays out, the wow factor of the note that Robert Kardashian reads has not diminished at all in 16 years. You're just still staggered by it.
Yeah.
The drama of him reading it, the notion that Simpson is at large as the cops tell you, and then to hear that note, which, it's funny, in 2010 we have to kind of, it's a very much if I did it note, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like a suicide note, but it admits nothing. That's the staggering moment. That's the real shock moment. And then you watch the car chase, and what you're thinking is, how does this end? I've seen a million movies that have a car chase with 10 minutes to go. How does this movie end?
And then,
and meanwhile, there's a game to be played in New York.
And the other moment that I think, you know, has still lived to the weight of when it happened 16 years later is when the cop says, you know, O.J. Simpson did not show up, blah, blah, blah. And there's a long pause and he goes, we are actively searching for Mr. Simpson. And you hear the crowd go, oh, like the media. The media never makes noise. That was the number one all-time media in shock noise, I think, that we've ever had.
Completely agree. I don't remember seeing that one live.
I don't either.
That was the moment where when everybody said, you got to get to your television. But to see that in the movie was, whew.
And then the
way the movie shows a guy like Bob Costas, who's live from he's live from Madison Square Garden, right? And
yeah,
consummate broadcaster, you know, again, trying to make sense of these two competing events. You know, it's everybody trying to do the math while something incredible is going on.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that would have been different if it happened now were the YouTube videos would have gone right up. People filming from the highway, people with their cell phones, people within a block of the house and all that stuff. And
one of the interesting things about what the internet has done, particularly when you think about this in terms of, you're running like an operation there today.
I know. Well, that kept the Joe DiMaggio streak alive of the me forgetting to unplug the phone and then it going off during the podcast. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What did I just say? It probably doesn't matter. It's a staggering thing to contemplate the whole deal. And then, you know, for the documentary to lay in, which weren't broadcast at the time, I'm sure, the conversations from the helicopter, from the cops to Simpson's car and stuff. The thing I was going to mention is what we saw with Tiger Woods, it seemed like websites like TMZ had an immediate line into the cops' thinking.
Mm.
Like right away we heard what was going on with the cops. And that seems to have been a trend of the internet now, is that aggressive news gathering sites tell you what the cops are thinking before the cops have felt like announcing it in a formal way. And so that would have really revved up the timeline in terms of who thought O.J. might be responsible for these murders. And like you say, that would have in turn turbocharged the conversation and created the conspiracy theories and things like that.
Well, yeah, and then I think information would have been leaked about the cut finger a lot earlier and that he didn't have an alibi. We would have found out about that stuff within 36 hours. And I also think it really would have been almost impossible in the internet era with all the info coming out right away, shaping the way we felt about it. I don't think there's any way he gets off. I just think it's impossible because I don't think they could have found 12 people who wouldn't have known anything about the case and wouldn't have had some sort of predisposed opinion, right? Or do you still think he gets off?
I just think the torpidity of the if there is such a word, of the trial was going to be taken out on somebody. I just think the endless lassitude of the trial, the fact that it just went on forever, that attorneys were allowed to argue points.
Yeah.
I mean, it just became like the thing that wouldn't go away. I think that, as much as anything, was the verdict that the jury was coming in with. You know, you have wasted our time. I don't really know that it was a careful sifting of the evidence. I just think it was a sense that they were fed up.
But post-CSI, though, post-CSI, if that happened in 2010, everyone understands DNA evidence now. He doesn't have a chance.
I don't know. Barry Scheck has gone on to do very well for lots of people as part of the Innocence Project. Wasn't he the guy leading the way on the DNA evidence? I don't really know. In terms of, as always, in a high-profile trial, if you can get the best experts, you can, there's always a chance that you can create doubt or uncertainty in people's minds. So
he was the guy who
really know that.
He went for the contamination angle, which
I guess that's right.
It was an interesting defense because they said the police officers were so cunning that at the scene they were able to basically frame O.J. for the murder. But at the same time, they were so incompetent that they bungled all the blood evidence.
Right.
So it was like,
I recall something like that. Yeah.
Are these guys cunning or are these guys idiots? Like, you got to pick one. You can't be a cunning idiot. You've got to pick one or the other.
It is kind of interesting, isn't it, that you don't really think of, oh, well, then there was that great book about the O.J. trial, you know. Then there was the book that we all read that really summed up O.J. for us. I don't know that book ever got read. I think we were kind of exhausted by the end of it all, that no one sort of ever put it together in a way that was enormously convincing. In the meantime, there are a lot of 15-year-old kids running around today who can owe their existence to the creation of Camp O.J. If you talk to people who work in television, the O.J. Simpson trial was a glorious time to be in the media. There was work for everyone.
A lot
of people started romances and got married and had kids, and so it was also a great stand for traditional media, just as you say, because there was so much to cover. There was news every day, and there were jurors, and there were these outlying things. But the reason why I think it's accurate to say that it is the beginning of reality television is that it is the first major event that really begins to spin off these famous for being famous individuals.
You really think that's true, though? You think that's true, though?
Resnick. You know, the real world was seen as a different thing. You know, the real world was young people living together. I don't think we understood the concept of reality television until Survivor, maybe. But as you look back, you think, well, here are a lot of people becoming famous just for being famous. Not because they could sing a song, not because they could dance, not because they could act, but just because he's Cato. She's Faye Resnick. She's Denise Brown. I'm not singling out these people so much, but
yeah. It
just seems she's juror number 9. You know, there was just an endless can of these people opened up who got into the public eye because, I don't know, just because. And they were fascinating, and we moved on. And those are the kinds of people we'd see a lot more of as the decade continued.
It's funny. I'm intrigued that you think that's when it started, because for me it was Donna Rice. That was
Donna
like
Rice.
That whole era was the – so I'm going to say like in the 86 to 88 range was the first time people were getting famous without having a talent, basically.
Well, I mean, I think there was always room for the mistress or alleged mistress to become famous. I'm not going to deny that.
You're saying the supporting characters.
I just interviewed Ola Ray the other day, who
yes.
was the woman in the Thriller video. And as perhaps you are aware, she was also a Playboy centerfold. She was a centerfold, I believe, in June 1980. The cover story was Rita Jenrette, who I'm not entirely sure about this, I believe was the curvaceous wife of a Republican congressman.
Yep.
So there was always room for, for the Jessica Hans of the world. Let's put it that way. But Cato Kaelin was not like that. He was kind of a figure out there, and he enjoyed a celebrity apart from posing in a magazine or apart from an intimate relationship of some kind. He just kind of was still there for no apparent reason. So I do think that kind of started.
That's
Even
a good
if you
point.
You were on The Real World. You were on TV. You were a star on television. If you were Puck, if you were, if you were any of those people from San Francisco, for example, you were on a hit show. Okay, people who are on hit shows are going to become famous. These guys weren't on hit shows. They were just there.
It's a good point. You swayed me, because the supporting characters that weren't even really major characters of this thing, and even if you look at, Marcia Clark's hair.
Yeah.
What a big deal that was with any conversation that anytime you're around girls that summer and that fall, whatever, they Marcia Clark's hair drove them crazy. That was like a dinner topic. Or Chris Darden.
And Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden were like the Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson of the time.
Right.
Were they dating? Were they involved,
And then you had Shapiro, you had Kardashian, what the hell was he doing? You had This Is AC, you had him. You had
Catherine,
Yeah.
But they're all figures that kind of passed through and not so many marks were left in a weird way. Except that we're still talking about that amazing day, 16 years ago. And to see it all together, the way he put it together it does really knock you back on your heels. You do feel like something's changing. Something is changing at that moment. You're not entirely sure what, but you do feel the ground shift under your feet even as you look back on it now and watch that movie.
You know what the number one movie was that weekend?
I don't.
Speed with Keanu Reeves. About a car chase on the LA freeway. A runaway bus. Isn't that unbelievable? All right, here's why you're on the Mount Rushmore, because only you can come up with answers to questions like this. Did the whole OJ thing change the way we feel about our heroes once and for all? Were we naive before June 17th, 1994, and then afterwards we had our guard up and we believed the worst in these guys, or were at least prepared for the worst with these guys other than just blindly believing in our heroes?
I think it opened up the possibility that anyone could be someone different from what we thought they were. That anyone could have a secret personality, a side we didn't know. That the people we thought we knew, we didn't know at all. Now, again, that sounds amazingly naive, not to have known going into it. But all you have to do is hear the voices, again, of Al Michaels and Tom Brokaw to realize, wow, I had no idea. I did not know. I didn't know he was even potentially capable of something like this. And so I think OJ, the whole saga, wore us out a little bit. It was a little like that old Marxian line that everything happens twice, once this tragedy and once this farce. And by the end of it all, the tragedy had gotten lost in the sauce, and it sort of seemed like farce at the end. But yeah, I think our guard would remain up. I think our suspicions about the people we loved in public would never go away. And, you also have, again, people like Michael Jackson right around then,
yeah,
who was stupendously beloved to a degree that maybe no one in my lifetime has been as a performer in 1983 and 84. And by the time this era came around, was involved with legal issues that changed the way we felt about him. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I also think we were in the position to know more about these people, even if they did not run afoul of the law, than we had been in years past, for the reasons you mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be that you and I would have a Bruce Springsteen bootleg from the show at Winterland in 1978, and that you and I would know the story about X celebrity or Y celebrity. But now, those bootlegs and those stories, everyone can have. You put it up on the internet and the world, the guy who lives in a small town in Iowa can know all the dirt that we in Hollywood thought we uniquely possessed. And that's different, too.
You mentioned that there wasn't a great book about the whole thing. And, you know, we don't need to get into the racial stuff with that, you know, with the trial and the kind of wounds that open. I don't think we need to do that this time. But I thought the best one of all the books, and I'm not saying it was great, but just the best kind of snapshot of everything that happened was Jeffrey Toobin's book. Because for some reason, I was a huge O.J. trial junkie. I think it was the fact that I was working about 10 hours a week at the time. But I threw myself into it.
And I was the same way with Watergate, you know?
Yeah.
I was in school. I was working over the summer. I must have watched every 1973. I could tell you everything that happened in the Watergate hearings. So,
yeah, and that was
thing. Yes.
That was me in 1994. But I think the one thing that when I think back about a writer that stood out during that stretch and a guy that was just a must read and a guy that really captured something, maybe not everything we want to capture, but definitely captured something, was Dominic Dunn. And the Vanity Fair things that he wrote every month. And he captured the effect that the trial had on L.A. and L.A.'s power elite and the black-white stuff. And I thought he hit the most points out of anybody. Do you agree?
And you're already mentioning people who really became known to the rest of us based on their work with O.J., based on their work during the O.J. trial. You know, the O.J. trial turned a lot of people who we didn't know before into familiar faces for us in print or on TV. And those two are right up there. I remember thinking Randall Sullivan in Rolling Stone was really good also. But
yeah,
the two guys you mentioned are absolutely, you know, absolutely did very well, you know, and warped things together. But you're right. It was a, it was something that you did call out for sort of knitting together. But for whatever reason, off the top of my head, I can't think of a book that all did it. But
well,
Dominic Dunn, Jeffrey Toobin, absolutely.
Dominic Dunn's book that he wrote ended up being one of those weird nonfiction fiction books where he is his...
The big era for that. Remember, that was right around... Is that around the time when Edmund Morris spent all those months with Ronald Reagan and then couldn't quite figure out how to write it as a book and so made like a nonfiction book, call it Dutch? I guess
the
forms were breaking back then.
I apologize for my cell phone. We've now had two phones going off, which, Jacqueline, I think that ties the record, right? We've never had three phones go off in a podcast. I don't think so.
If I didn't know better, I think you were running a bookie joint.
Yeah, well, I might be. Yeah, that was somebody calling in 10,000 on the Celtics plus +7. Let's shift gears. Celtics Lakers, 2010 finals. You're a sports fan. I wouldn't call you a diehard NBA junkie, but you're like a big picture sports guy. You love like the big angles, the big games, things like that.
Yeah.
When was the last time we're taping this on a Thursday morning? So when was the last?
What happens then? Yeah.
Right. When was the last time you remember a game this quote unquote big in the National Basketball Association?
That's hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of it sort of depends on your rooting interest, you know. I grew up in New York, you know, so I maybe have stronger feelings about Knicks Rockets than you might, for example.
Good point.
And that had sort of the through line of Riley's relationship to John Starks.
Yeah.
That he had sort of found and nurtured and made into a New York icon, and Starks having a bad shooting day, and would he stay with Starks? Would he pull Starks? What was Starks' confidence like? Was there any moment when Starks might turn things around? I certainly thought of that after, Ray Allen had that incredible game and then couldn't find the basket the next game. you just are always wondering with those great shooters. Even you said that three he took from the corner, even after having missed all those shots.
Yeah.
You said the roof would have come off of the Boston Garden if he'd hit that shot. You know, it was the same thing if you were watching that and thinking, is Starks finally going to, is it going to happen? And that relationship, too, there was something powerful in that. But I know what you mean. That doesn't really qualify in terms of the clash of the Titans nature of this one. The strange thing about this one, and I guess people have brought it up before, is somebody said no classic games to this point. There have been really entertaining games, but no classic games. You think, what's the key matchup tonight? What's the question that gets answered? What's the fundamental thing we learn at the end of all this? Sometimes you feel like if they played 100 games, each of these guys would win 50, right?
Yep.
But they're going to have one more, and then everyone's going to go home for the summer. And so you'll probably agree with me that the classic matchup of this game is Kobe Bryant versus Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I pre-wrote about 2,100 words for the running diary I'm going to do tonight because I know I'm going to be a quivering mess and I wanted to get as much thought out. So I did top 18 storylines that by the time people hear this podcast, it might
They'll
not
be
up yet. Yeah, right. Well, no, I don't think it'll be up yet, but
yours
it doesn't matter.
Be moot. No, I'm saying my little riffs will be moot. Yeah.
No, I'm saying my first two storylines were Kobe Bryant, which sounds weird, but the first storyline was obviously that I think he has the most at stake out of any individual player because if he loses a game 7 of the finals at home, that becomes a first paragraph NBA obituary moment for him because he's the best player in the series. They're two even teams. And if he's really a top 10 player, he should take care of business tonight. And if he doesn't, that is something that people always point at and say, you know, Jordan would have never lost that game. Magic would have taken care of a game 7 at home. So would a Bird. I think that's, you know, at the very least, like Jerry West in 1969, who ended up winning the MVP of that series, and they lost at home, they lost the game 7, but he had 42 points, 13 rebounds, 12 assists. And anybody who watched that game said, that guy did everything he could do for his team to win, the rest of the guys just weren't good enough. So at the very least, if they lose, I think Kobe has to play at that level, and if he doesn't, it opens up all the old questions about how great is this guy really. You know, and then, so that's the first storyline. The second storyline is, I think out of anybody playing, he seems to have the biggest sense of his own career and NBA history and stuff like that. I think he's very aware of storyline number one. So how will he play if the Celtics come out and they're up 8 in the third quarter and he starts thinking, you know, forget about winning the game. Like, oh my God, this is now on my watch. I got to do something. And that's when it'll get really interesting.
I'm not sure I agree with you about point number one, but I certainly agree with you about point number two, that you know, this is such a mental test for someone who has the capacity to take over a game at any point, for good or ill. How do you play within the game when the stakes are so high? You know, I feel like we haven't learned so much in the course of this series in the way that we like to think that we learn things. We think one thing and the next game is completely different. We think, well, now we understand that this is going to happen and then the next game completely refutes that. It's been a little difficult series, I think, to get a storyline handle on for that reason. At least in the minimal way in which I look at things. So, in a way, I kind of dread all the people who will write, well, I knew this would happen, or we knew this would take place, or the guys in the locker room who will say, we knew this, we knew that. Who knows? It just seems like every game comes out of a different bag. It's like, the punchline for this one is everyone says we came out more aggressive, right? That's the one thing that is the complimentary word of the series. Why did you win? Well, we came out more aggressive. Why didn't you win? We need to be more aggressive.
We got a lot of energy plays.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, and we had energy. We had a lot of energy.
I know. I went more aggressive. Well, three guys with whistles, you know, didn't like your aggressiveness so much, and that really hurt you. Or I don't know. Of course, everybody's going to be aggressive. Everybody's going to try really hard. I think there's been no shortage of effort pretty much throughout this entire series. It's, is Ray Allen less aggressive when he misses all those shots as when he hits all those shots? It's kind of the way it goes. So,
yeah.
In a way, because of the way this series has gone, I feel less like, I feel less inclined to draw the great historical lessons because it's been so random in a way. They'll come out, you know, it's like you reach into the bag and you pull out game three. You reach into the bag and you pull out game six. You reach into the bag, you pull out game two. And now we'll see what game seven looks like. But will it be the apotheosis of what these two teams are? Will it be the apotheosis of who Kobe Bryant is? I don't necessarily know that. And the thing, of course, you worry about is it will turn on a fluke or a bad call or something like that. But we'll see. Certainly, I think you're right, though, that Kobe has a sense of this historical moment and how that affects the way he plays and the degree that he trusts his teammates will be very interesting to watch.
I had, after the LeBron thing, I wrote a column about trying to figure out what was important to him. And a reader...
Yeah, I really liked that. I thought that was really good.
Thank you. A reader sent me an email about how you can describe the great players in one word with what's important to them. And with Jordan, he said winning. And with Kobe, he said greatness, which is, I guess, like an offshoot of winning. He thought that the most important thing for Kobe Bryant was to be great, not necessarily to win. It was to win as he's being great. Do you agree with that?
I thought that was a fascinating insight. Yes, that's why I remember that, and I thought that was really interesting. In a way, I thought you had a number of people grouped at winning, didn't you? You had like Walton and a lot
of them. Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
There has to be some other word for Jordan. You know, it has to be winning plus. You know, it has to be like...
Pathological like, winning.
Yes, like subjugation almost. You know,
yeah.
or like he wanted to destroy you,
vanquish.
You know, mentally, yes. He wanted to do to you what he attempted to verbally do in his Hall of Fame speech.
Yep.
You know, he wanted to break your confidence, like permanently. When you think of somebody like winning, we think of Walton or any of those John Wooden guys like that. You think of winning as a team. We did it as a team. This was great. Jordan wanted to snap the will of the people he played against, and that was so mesmerizingly great about him. So there needs to be like a hyper winning for him. That's true, and how fitting that he always seemed to be able to get to do it. You know, he didn't just hit the big shot; that he took the ball from Karl Malone. You know, again and again and again, that kind of thing. So,
well, with Kobe,
it'll be fascinating.
Yeah, with Kobe. There's no way to prove this, obviously, but if you said to Kobe, you have a 65% chance of winning, but you'll have 20 points and 11 assists and 9 rebounds, and Gasol will be the best guy in this game, and Gasol will have 34 points, and everybody will say Pau Gasol was the hero of that game, or you have a 40% chance of winning, but you will score 49 points, and there will be no doubt after this game that you will be considered one of the best players ever. Pick one of the two. I'd be interested to see what he picked.
I don't think that's the situation. I think because he's the figure, because he's the preeminent figure, winning implicitly confers upon him. You know,
all right.
if he wins for that reason, and I think he's smart enough to know this. If he wins for that reason, then he is acclaimed as the guy who is able to defer or, you know, pass the ball to Steve Kerr or something like that at a key moment to enable them to win. The thing is just that gut thing. When you walk out on the court and you feel like you're the best player, like you said, and that you have the capacity to dominate a game, as we've seen already, do you need to check that? Do you need to monitor that amid all the craziness of a game seven? Can you hold it together and make those passes and set those teammates up to be able to have the team win? I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think that the finals has kind of brought everything from the Kobe table because...
But, you know, he lacks an antagonist. We're talking Kobe versus Kobe, and that's because you have a kind of, in Boston, he lacks the one-on-one antagonist.
That's a good point.
That would make it, you know, Ali versus Frazier. You know, you guys are, the Celtics are multi-form. They're, you know, one guy shows up, one guy, you know, there are three or four guys who can set the tone for the game. Not the one guy that Kobe will be thinking about before he takes the floor.
I like that point because, like, let's say Dwayne Wade was on the Celtics. This is a whole different series from a plotline standpoint.
Yeah.
Now it's Kobe versus Wade. Whoever plays the best out of these two is probably going to win. And that
Kobe
would
versus
be
LeBron, you know, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that was what we all thought we were going to be. But maybe it's Pierce. Maybe it's Garnett. Maybe it's Rondo. Maybe it's Ray Allen going off, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know.
I actually think Rondo is the key to the game tonight because I watched that game six again and the Lakers just said, we're not guarding you and you shoot jumpers and go to the rim, but we don't care. We're going to try to stop everybody else. And he was tentative and now we're back to the old tentative aggressive thing that you've made fun of before, but he didn't play that way in the playoffs and the Celtics certainly didn't advance to game seven of the finals by him being tentative. And when he was aggressive, it was kind of misplaced and he didn't really harness it. He just wasn't playing well. And, you know, they wouldn't have made the finals if he played like that in the Cleveland series. So, you know, you're talking about a guy who I think has the potential to be great, who has done it before in the playoffs, who, if he does it again, assuming, you know, nothing fishy with the officials and no serious foul trouble or anything, I think the Celtics could win. And he's 23 years old and, you know, who knows? I just don't know.
Well, yeah, you think, it's funny how you think that guys who sometimes play best under pressure, guys who don't know better.
Yeah.
You know, we've all seen that guys were too young to realize the import of what they're doing. You know, maybe he's like that particular occasion.
Are you one of those guys who feels like you have to win the title or you have to win the game seven at home? Or like when you're talking about history and a guy's career, like, do you look less on somebody like Karl Malone's resume or Charles Barkley's resume because they never won a title?
You have to adjust for the teams and everything like that, but you can't not. You have to. It has to be, it doesn't mean their careers are failures. It doesn't mean they aren't tremendous players who need, who deserve our love and appreciation. But it does count for something.
Yeah.
You can't not count for something. Jerry West was a perfect example. If Jerry West had never won a title, Jerry West is a great player who needs to, who never needed to apologize for anything. But if he didn't win a title, you'd think about that, I may think that Patrick Ewing is a greater player than you do, but he didn't win a title. I have to, you have to acknowledge that. You have to nod like that and say, that's the coin of the realm. That's how you get the respect. So,
you know what's funny, though, with the media?
All these guys have won titles already. That's the other thing.
Right.
Nobody's pining for the ring they don't have. They have the rings already.
The funny thing about the media is the guys who push the agenda hardest that you don't need a title to be great or you don't, it's team sport, all that stuff. It's usually people who haven't won a title. You don't need a title to be great. You're a great player and so much depends on luck and your teammates, stuff like that. I personally think, this is what sports is all about. It's a game seven. You got to take care of business. You step up. These are where legends are made. Like you look at somebody like Clyde Frazier. If he doesn't have 36 points and 19 assists in Game 7 of the 1970 Finals, I don't think we remember him the same way. Same thing with Big Game James. James Worthy is Big Game James, but 1988, that's why he's Big Game James.
I understand what you're saying about Game 7 and there's a lot of drama. Is there some part of you that thinks, this almost reminds me a little of that Jerry Lucas, Jerry Lucas Dean Memminger brand of the Knicks, that because it's the second title for both teams, historically it may not, it may not have the same impact as that first one did.
You bring that up, the people keep pointing to parallels with this 2010 Celtics team and like the 69 Celtics or the 74 Celtics, and the comparison is the 73 Knicks because that was kind of an old semi-washed up team that nobody really expected anything from, and they played really well together, and it was a weird season, and I think this has been a weird season. And they just kind of snuck in and snuck it out. But I just think
win. Yeah, and when it's the second time, it just doesn't, it's harder to write the great story when they've come back and done it for the second time. I wonder if you think that this playoff series, these playoffs mean that the NBA has become more like the NHL in terms of the difference between the regular season and the postseason.
Yeah, I think when you look at what the Celtics did and the fact that they basically made a decision, we're not going to kill ourselves in the regular season. We don't care what playoff spot we get. All we want to do is play hard for 2 months. That's fine. It worked. It got them to a game seven. But good thing my dad is still here. Hey, Dad. You paid for the 2009-2010 season. You saw 16 home losses. You said it was one of your least favorite Celtic seasons ever. Now that we're in the finals, was it worth it to pay all that money?
It was worth it, but I'll never forgive Rasheed Wallace for mailing it in the whole season. And if you sat there watching his lack of effort and how overweight he was the entire season, it's just puzzling how a pro athlete could approach his professional sport that way.
What do you think, Chris Connolly?
I think the Boston Celtics management, regardless of what happens tonight, should send every season ticket holder a switch.
An on and off switch? It's a good idea.
A switch.
Well, I do think
this was a switch we kept talking about throwing. Turns out there actually is a switch. We thought you'd want to have one.
Yeah. And, you know, instead of the 2009-2010 championship banner, maybe it should just be a switch.
One big light switch. Yeah, it gets pulled up to the rafters.
Well,
flicked into the on position.
I do think, though, that
I, by the way, was interviewing Rasheed Wallace backstage for MTV at what I think were the Source Awards, when a fight broke out between Mac Minister and, I believe, E-40, and the whole place cleared out. I want to point out that Rasheed had nothing to do with that fight whatsoever, and in fact was a very charming and nice guy to talk to about hip-hop.
He was an underrated peacemaker during the Artest melee, too.
That's right.
He was the one guy who...
Not a violent man by any stretch, yeah.
No, not a violent man. So do you think, regardless of how this finals plays out, the NBA might need to refigure their strategy for these 82-game regular seasons?
I don't know. I think
what do you mean you don't know? That's a terrible answer. You don't know. You're supposed to know. You're a Mount Rushmore guest.
I enjoyed all those games. I liked watching those games. I think sometimes watching the NHL, you feel like they know it doesn't matter so much and we're all going to the playoffs. And
yeah.
But I can't say I don't enjoy watching the games. I think, obviously, that for LeBron personally, the Cavs as a team, this was a huge, like, mental wake-up call. You know, that I think you pointed out that the idea of having a lot of fun and, you know, cheerfully rocking your way to victory just doesn't seem to work in the slog that is these playoffs. But
yeah.
I can't say I didn't enjoy watching the games. They were a lot of fun this year. It just seemed like they became very different in the playoffs. But they were still great to watch. I thought it was a great season.
We learned a couple things this year that we already knew, but we forgot. And one is that it doesn't matter how many chest bumps you're doing before the game and how you're playing when you're up 20. It matters the number of gamers that you have on your team and guys who are going to show up. Buke calls those guys gamers. Buker, Rick Buker. And I like that because, you know, look at the Celtics. They have guys that are not going to be afraid tonight. Like, I know, like, Celtics might lose, but I know KG is going to show up. He might not want to take a shot in the last 2 minutes, but he's going to be playing hard. Pierce is not going to be afraid. Ray Allen's not going to be afraid. Rondo might be tentative, but he's definitely not afraid. He just, I don't think he's put it all together yet. And I don't think Big Baby Davis and I don't think Rasheed will be afraid. And actually, I'm afraid that Rasheed's not afraid because I think he'll absolutely shoot the biggest shot of the game. And then on the flip side...
To be honest with you, I think you could say the same thing about all the Lakers. I mean, I think by the time you get to Game 7, absolutely, you know. They've all proven that they got it that way. It seems to me like it's when can you get a stop? When can you absolutely get a stop? When you need to get a stop, how do you get a stop? And the guys who can do it and the guys who can't do it seem to filter through one way or another.
And you look at that Cavs team the last 2 years, and yeah, they look good on paper, and yeah, they're winning 60 games a year. But I don't know who I trust on that team in a big game other than LeBron and Varejao, and I think that's, you know, Varejao was hurt this year, but that's eventually what we learned with that team is that when the going got tough, they got going. So that's maybe one thing to look at next year. And then the other thing is you got to protect the rim and the paint. And year after year after year, the teams that either win the title or come close are the teams that control the five feet around the paint and control the area above the rim. And that's what made me so mad that I picked Dallas. You know, heading into April, I picked Dallas to make the finals. And that's a team that doesn't protect the rim or the paint. So I'm an idiot, basically.
Well, remember, as I always say, if we were in the English Premier League, it would all be different. Right. Winners of the regular season would already have their medals. They would have had their trophy. They would have gotten to run around the stadium, accept the plaudits of their grateful fans, right along with that Seattle Mariners team that won 115 games. So it's we just do it a little differently here. But I certainly agree with what you're saying.
Your take on Laker fans without getting yourself killed.
I think they're as passionate as, I think you pointed it out as well. They are passionate and they are surprisingly knowledgeable. You know, I'm from New York, you're from Boston. We have a certain level of expectation in terms of what fans should be like, but I think they're more knowledgeable and passionate than they're typically given credit for.
I would agree. And I think the problem with the perception around the country of Laker fans is that they're judging the Laker fans by the people that go to the big Laker games. And a lot of times that just comes down to access and money versus who's the biggest fan.
That's true. And yet among, I'd say, celebrities, there are people who are passionate fans and who feel the same way. And, you know, Jack is obviously one of them, but there are others there as well. And I'm sure they'll be heard from tonight. We will be really interested to see who gets tickets tonight. Obviously, that's the case.
Toughest Laker ticket probably in 22 years, I'm saying, since 88 game 7 Lakers Pistons. That'd be my guess.
I guess that's probably right.
And also,
you know, if you're a fan, if you're really a fan, you know, if you understand that no matter how famous you are, the game is going to be much bigger than you, then this is the place to be.
As somebody who is a celebrity sports crosser, for lack of a better word, you must kind of secretly enjoy the whole hierarchy that exists in Hollywood that tends to manifest itself at these huge basketball games, depending on who's sitting where. It's kind of like
you have to be. I mean, you talk about guys who've stepped it up in the finals.
Yeah,
you have to be impressed with Diddy and Snoop Dogg.
Oh yeah,
but like, tell me you expected to see Snoop Dogg in those seats for a game 6?
Unbelievable. Well, he only had him for a half.
That's true, but he got a photograph there. He stepped it up when he needed to. He stepped up. People might have counted him out, might have thought he wasn't really a Laker fan, you know. He stepped it up. He got the seats, you know, when he needed them. So you have to say he's the surprise performer of the playoffs in terms of fans.
Oh, I would say Maria Menounos getting courtside for even a half was the upset of the entire playoffs, even surpassing Celtics-Cavs. On the court side, game 6, wearing a Celtic jersey. I think the Lakers decided that she needed to go because she left at halftime. Or not left, well, but was moved to a different seat, basically.
You know, you, in some cases, I guess, you just need one person to believe in you.
Yeah.
You know, it's, remember you said how every locker room, you know, thrives on the idea nobody believed in us?
Yeah.
I think if you're a fan, a famous fan, you can say, one person believed in me, and he gave me his tickets. That's all you need to step it up.
And Leo's a legitimate fan.
Yes, yes.
I'm sold on Leo. And actually, I heard an awesome story about Leo. They're filming Shutter Island, Massachusetts in 2008. And he's a big Laker fan. And he had a back and forth with the crew about the finals. A lot of good natured trash talking for 2 solid weeks. And we're going to kick your butt, all that stuff. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Celtics win game 6 by 39 points. They win the title. A couple days later, Leo arranges to get the trophy that the Celtics just won to come to the set and takes a picture with every member of the crew with him and the trophy as his way of paying off the quote-unquote bet, which wasn't even really a bet. But story made me like Leo.
I think you have to admire anybody who's a fan and is also willing to take the, you know, the responsibility for when your team doesn't perform as you want. Rather than writing it off or blaming it on something else or pretending like it didn't happen. So I always appreciate that in somebody either way.
Answer me this. So court sides for the finals, probably in the 10 to 15 range. I think for game 7 tonight, probably 30K, something like that.
I couldn't tell you that I knew. I'm sure in so many ways it's so much bigger than that, you know. And you have to be willing to star in my really bad sequel.
Well, so I did some research on it, and it seems like the consensus is 30K to 35K per seat for tonight's game. Now,
okay.
if you're a Hollywood company, a Hollywood studio, I'm sorry, and you have a movie coming out, like let's say you have Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise in this movie coming out, and
sure,
you get 2 of those seats for 80 grand and they're courtside, and you put them there, and you know that 2 or 3 times during the game they're going to get shown. Isn't that good promotion for the movie, or am I crazy? I think those courtside seats should go for more.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You know, but I keep thinking it must be like a deeper favor bank than that. That can't really be expressed in money. It's more like, and you'll, you know, and because we give you these seats, you'll make sure to make sure our entire team can visit this set or something like that. These are transactions taking place on the high level of celebrity.
Because in game one, the four stars of Grown Ups sat right next to the Laker bench, and you know they also bought a commercial. And they came out of commercial, they showed him. Doris Burke interviewed Chris Rock at one point. I was thinking, like, this is the best promotion this movie's ever going to get. There's 12 million people watching this game.
You can't go wrong. You know, they like each other. They're knowledgeable. They're talking about the game. I think, you know, I couldn't agree more.
At what point during the filming of Grown Ups did somebody get drunk and yell at Kevin James that he was no Chris Farley?
You know, you have to understand. I think if you look at that fistful of people, who has the most successful, most recent movie?
Oh, you're right, Kevin James.
I think the mall cop gets to tell them to all, you know, get lost. I think he has the most recent big hit. So, in the way that, unless I'm forgetting some film, in the way that props are distributed, he need not take stuff from anybody.
It's a very good point. That's why you're on the Mount Rushmore, Chris Connolly. I didn't think of that.
It constantly slips back and forth, and that's how we began our conversation.
How about that? You didn't think of this one. So, the NBA career and the movie career seem to have kind of a parallel. Because you got, like, let's look at Jim Carrey, for instance. So, Jim Carrey, late 80s, whatever, he's a stand-up comedian, goes on in Living Color, or Living Color, I can never remember whether the band was in Living Color or the show was, ends up getting Ace Ventura Pet Detective, I think around 93. Career takes off, Dumb and Dumber Mask. Now it's 2010, kind of on his way out. That is basically how an NBA career would go, right? You have your prime of 7-8 years, then you hang on for the extra few years, and now I'm not sure that he can open a movie anymore.
Well, I'm sure he'd like a big hit like they all would. I think the audience, particularly in comedies, kind of, you know, waxes and wanes with their affection if you're making them laugh,
right,
particularly based on how ambitious you are. The difference is that Jim Carrey can't get a job sitting next to a bunch of guys from our esteemed network and talk about how other guys are funny or not funny in movies, which would be pretty great, you have to admit.
That would be incredible.
If guys who, you know, guys are coming up in new comedies now, like, you know, if you could have like a whole table, like at Broadway Danny Rose or something, like in the back of the stage delicatessen, you could have a table of guys saying, I frankly didn't think that Seth Rogen film was that at all. Seth Rogen has got to be more aggressive with the punchline.
Right. So, yeah, he couldn't be C-Web.
I frankly thought he was passive in that scene with the ingenue. You know, if you get the opportunity to helm, to be above the title on a $50 million movie, you have got to be aggressive.
Right.
That would be awesome.
So you have your window where you can open movies and people will come because you're in them. Like, say Al Pacino, long career, maybe like a Carl Malone, John Stockton type career, 1972 through maybe Heat, 1994, 22-year career. And out of the last 16 years, he's settled into a career of, not really, you're not going to go out of your way to see a movie that he's in unless the reviews say that it's awesome. And maybe you could say he's in his coaching broadcasting phase of his career as a player.
I think of him more as like the late Iverson phase. Because if you get him the ball, he'll shoot it. Because the other thing that happens with some of these actors is that they'll take a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
They maybe don't tend to their legacy always as much as we would like to. You want to pay me X amount of dollars to be in a movie? You got it. So it has a little like late Iverson going on. If you want to pass me the ball, I will shoot the ball. I won't be as discriminating as you would hope I would be, but I will shoot the ball.
Eventually,
it's that famous moment, like you would say from the Rocky movies, where the guy puts his hand on your shoulder and says, champ, how about you stop acting for a while?
Did you see the John Cazale documentary?
I didn't, and In fact, I didn't know it existed until I read about it on your Twitter page.
Yes.
I saw it in Shakespeare in the Park. when I was in high school or college, and he was tremendous. So I would be very eager to see it. I was a big fan.
5 for 5. I don't know if we'll see that again. 5 great movies. Every movie he was in was nominated for an Oscar.
And irreplaceable in a way. I mean, just with a quality of, a kind of melancholy about him that was mesmerizing. It was really impossible to pull away from. A guy who really wasn't replaced. A guy who they can always, God bless them, they can always find a new leading man, but when a guy like that goes, another guy doesn't come around like him, I don't think.
Yeah, it's an interesting game to play. You could go two ways with it. You could go the Kurt Cobain way of, when was the best time for that guy to have died? Like for example, De Niro. Let's say De Niro is in a plane crash right after The Deer Hunter comes out. We speak of him in exalted terms. And we kind of do anyway, but you know what I mean?
I think with him we do anyway. I think once they establish, but it's much more true in terms of pop music,
Oh, good point.
What if Jimi Hendrix had lived on to play the Foxwoods Casino?
Yes.
What if we'd seen Janis Joplin as a guest judge on America's Got Talent? At some point, sad as you are that they've died, their legends are sustained by the fact that we only have an image of them as being young people. It's certainly truer for pop.
Well, that was the second game, when they hang on too long and you get in a situation like with Whitney Houston. Where if Whitney Houston dies right after The Bodyguard, she's actually hurt her legacy that she stuck around these last 18 years. And now people are more prone to remember her as the bloated, deeply troubled singer who hasn't been really good for a long time and who wasted a beautiful voice. And that's now her legacy.
But now you're talking like a slightly heightened level of emotional involvement. And you sort of see it with Britney. It's like people still root for Britney. In all the trouble she's been through, you could have said, wow, if only she had passed from the scene, not literally but figuratively, at the moment of her greatest celebrity, she'd be considered like the Jean Harlow of her era or something.
Yeah.
But people have never lost the residual affection for her. And to a degree, the same thing is true for Whitney. The reason why she still compels us is that we're still hoping that she'll turn it around. We're still hoping that she's got one or two big swings left in her, that she's the David Ortiz of pop music, that just as we all think that she's finished, she's going to come out of nowhere and thrill us with something we didn't see coming. And that's because we have this residual affection. And if you ever need to understand why Michael Jackson is still as compelling to us as he is now, it's because so many people grew up with him and retained that affection through every bad thing that was attached to his name.
He's had maybe the most improbable and greatest resurgence of anyone in the last 10 years. His music is on all the time, though. He's discovered a whole new generation of fans that had, just knew him as the guy whose skin changed color and may have molested people. And now nobody cares anymore. It's just, yeah, that guy made some great music.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yep. And in a sad way, his death offers us license to feel that way about the music again. Without thinking about those other things. At the front of our brains the way we used to.
I think going in the hip-hop rap world for a second, the Tupac and Biggie deaths may have been also the same, because I think we found, as the careers of these rappers have, the ones we've seen the last 15, 20 years, it seems like they have the most to say in that first or second album. And then
I think Tupac's death is the most significant pop music passing of the last 40 years.
I agree.
I think Tupac's death is, if you took, did you ever, in college we all read the autobiography of Malcolm X. Did you ever have the opportunity to read that?
Of course.
Then if you ripped out the last 200 pages of the autobiography of Malcolm X, that's Tupac's life. I have always wondered in my mind, given how unusual he was, that he would have gone on to a really unique and special place in American life somehow, that this would have just been a phase. I completely agree that he might not have been the rapper that he was, but he was so smart and so intelligent and had such an unusual upbringing that remarkable things could have happened for him. Completely unpredictable things, the way that it sometimes happens in American life.
I hope you're right.
It's been a great loss.
I hope you're right, because he's one of my all-time favorites, and I feel that way. You know, like how you just described, at the same time, the track record isn't good for these guys. And really, like, you know, I think the worst thing that happens is their lives change so much that they no longer know how to make compelling music about it, you know, because it's like the first part of whatever.
And we associate them with our youth, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens in pop music a lot. We so think of them as being, I mean, only in sports. Would we think that someone could do something better at 27 than they could at 31? Except that we sort of assign that to pop music as well. Wow, he made great music when he was 27. Why isn't the music good at 31? It might even be better, but we just associate him with our youth. We want him or her to stay young. And it's a difficult reminder that we're getting old when they get old. We don't like that. We prefer to remember them when we were young and they were young. And that's why they could come up with 50 Michael Jackson songs that are fantastic, that are in the vault somewhere, but the ones that we'll love are the ones that remind us of being young and having a great time.
The one thing
about Tupac, though, you mentioning about Tupac, and I have always thought this, that there are people in American life who truly are unique. You think of all the athletes we're talking about. Think of everybody in the series, the finals tonight. There's been other players like Paul Pierce. There'll be other guys like Kevin Garnett. There'll be other guys even like Gasol or like Ray Allen. There'll never be anybody quite like Kobe, I don't think. A guy who grew up in Italy, a guy who grew up living soccer. Like Kobe could truly think, there is nobody going to be quite like me at this level of the NBA ever. My upbringing is so unique that I'm truly different from anybody I know. I lack peers because no one can fully understand the life that I lived growing up. And I always thought Tupac was the same way. There'd be a million rappers. There'll never be a rapper whose mother defended herself in a trial, that the government had against people who were Black Panthers. There'll never be a rapper who read the New York Times every single day when they were really young. There'll never be a rapper who had that kind of upbringing, who read every piece of revolutionary literature, who knew all that stuff, who went to a music and art school and it was in the Nutcracker and Romeo and Juliet. When are we going to see another one like that? That's probably not going to happen either.
And his material, out of anyone, he could vacillate between, you know, just great raw rap music that with lyrics and, you know, lyrics that you could actually like read almost, you know, you go online and read his lyrics and they could have been released in a book. And I think they have. And then on the other side,
a guy who teaches, you know, inner city English, you know, at a public school here, the only book they can't keep in the library is The Rose That Grew From Concrete. The book of Tupac.
Yeah, that's what it's called. You're right. But so he had that side, but then he also had the side where he could get the angriest and escalate it the most out of anybody.
Yeah.
And he was always battling between those two guys.
Yeah.
The reason I worry, you know, I think about Tupac and Biggie, and if I had to bet on it, I would say that just because of the way Biggie's styling, the way he did it, and just Tupac's lyrics, like I think they would have endured. But Eminem kind of screwed it up for me, because I think if you look at Eminem, and that's a guy who just hasn't endured. And 6 years ago, I would have bet anything that guy was going to have a 20-year career. And I don't know what happened to him.
I think he was so socially uncomfortable. You know, he was very much like, we saw this a lot in rock and roll, guys who were torn between, you know, success and being true to the street or their working class upbringing or something. You know, the two counterexamples, the guys who could handle it and the guys who couldn't, you would say the Clash sort of fell apart because of the inherent contradictions of being the proletarian band that was hugely successful. And U2, who figured out a way to keep what it was that was significant about their message and take it to ever greater heights.
And who stayed together. They stayed together, which made them more different than anybody.
And stay together, yeah. And I think you're, you know, you talk about someone like Eminem, you just had someone who was really uncomfortable for a long time with you know, with the nature of the show business that he was in.
Yeah.
You know, meeting other people, or, you know, he wanted to so be that guy from, you know, Detroit. And I think it was, you know, very hard on him, and perhaps led to some of the issues with substance abuse that he has acknowledged and stuff. Interesting that someone like him would have come to rely on Elton John as a kind of mentor in terms of negotiating his drug use and figuring out how to stay clean and stuff. So yeah, I wouldn't count him out, but you know, it's that same sort of thing. How do I remain who I feel like I need to be for my music while coping with this enormous success that changes the type of people I spend my day with?
And the only guy who's really successfully done it for 10 plus years and stayed relevant and managed to keep finding ways to stay relevant is Jay-Z.
And has he ever? I mean,
yeah.
What a, you know, that's the book to read, everybody. it's like if you want to read, like, how do you do it? You do what he did.
Right.
Just do whatever he did, you know? He's like the ultimate anti-Elvis.
Yeah.
Like, how do you let success make you into a greater and more fascinating individual? This is how you do it.
Yeah. It's almost a Madonna blueprint to some degree of he was able to reinvent himself a couple times. A nice high-profile marriage that actually worked, unlike Madonna's.
Stay interested.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really helps. Stay interested in what's going on, you know? People always ripped, you know, Madge back and forth for all the crazy things she did. She never stopped being interested in the outside world. That's why they're, you know, maybe thought she was ripping off influences and stuff, but she was smart, and she stayed interested. And, you know, he's done that on every level, and that's why people find him so compelling.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know Tupac, but I do think that he always felt he was going to die, which is a bad – he always felt like he was going to die young, and a lot of his music was about that. And it's probably a bad self-fulfilling prophecy to try to live up to. I'm going to die.
The era was so turbulent. There was so much gunfire. I mean, what you hate to think of is there was so much romance connected to the idea of being gunned down. That's the problem, you know?
Yeah. Not anymore.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I like your point about Kobe being unique, because I even wrote my book about Hakeem Olajuwon, and there are certain guys that just there is no way for anybody to kind of follow the steps that they followed. And, you know, I think the other thing that people forget with Kobe is that as he was rising up in the league those first couple of years, Jordan was at his apex and was leaving the league. And he, you know, almost immediately had that guy to measure himself up to. And I think Matt and Michael had the same thing with Bird and Magic. So the next guys, I think, you know, if Kobe pulls this off and wins a game 7 and now moves into the top 8 all time. And now you're talking about LeBron, Dwayne Wade, Durant. Those are guys now, this next generation, that will be looking at Kobe and saying, I want to pass him someday. And I don't think he fully has that place yet, but tonight we'll secure it. So. Good way to end.
And one of the
us.
First people who sort of picked up on it was Phil Jackson, and I remember he mentioned it, I think, when Kobe decided to get married, you know. It's like, wow, he seems really young, and she seems really young, and I think it was Phil Jackson said, he's different, you know.
Yeah.
He sees himself differently, and I'm sure still does.
Well, that was a good way to end. Hey, Dad, how you feeling now? We're about 4 hours away.
I'm getting more nervous.
Yeah, he's been sitting there doodling and listening to us.
Just please stop the cutting. That's all I ask. Stop the cutting.
What's your best case scenario for tonight, Dad? Who's the guy that we need the most?
Pierce. I'm looking for Pierce to have a game 7 type game like he did against LeBron 2 years ago in the semis.
And what's your worst case scenario? Rashid getting 3,004 minutes and Scalabrine taking off the warm-up jacket?
That could be one of my worst case scenarios, yes.
Do you think are you worried at all about us leaving the Staples Center tonight?
Not at all.
I'm a little worried. I hope nobody beats me to death tonight with my $3,000 laptop.
I'm going to be walking behind you though, because nobody recognizes me.
All right. Chris Connolly, the Mount Rushmore of podcast guests in the top 4.
Thanks for having
all
me,
time.
Bill. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll see what the night brings.
Hey, wait a second. Anything to plug?
I have a, Two things. 2-hour first anniversary of Michael Jackson's passing special on 2020 coming up next Friday. So you'll want to watch that. And then before you know it, it's going to be my wish time. So lots of great kids again this year getting their sports wishes, people you'll really enjoy getting to meet.
Well, I hope we film one tonight where the Celtics win a Game 7 at the Staples Center. That's my wish for at least tonight, June 17th, 2010. Game 7 of the NBA Finals coming tonight. Chris Connolly, thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.